Welcome to NGA Notable Lectures, a podcast offering a deeper understanding of all things artistic. On April 4th, 2015, a special screening at the National Gallery of Art of a film from the Center for Documentary Studies, CDS, at Duke University was presented in collaboration with the John F. Kennedy Center for the Performing Arts. In My Mind of 2010 documents jazz musician Jason Moran and the Big Bandwagon's original interpretation of a legendary 1959 performance by Thelonious Monk. Called A Masterpiece of Music Documentary Craft by Slant Magazine, In My Mind was written and directed by filmmaker and CDS instructor Gary Hawkins and filmed as part of his intermediate documentary filmmaking course, with students participating in the shooting. The project grew out of Moran's residency at Duke University and CDS's Jazz Loft project.
Thank you all so much again for coming. My name is Joanna and I work in the film department. And I would like to just very briefly give you a little bit of background about each of our guests today. We have documentary film producer Emily Ledoux is here. She's currently a doctoral student at the Annenberg School for Communication at the University of Pennsylvania. She holds an honors BA from Duke University in Literature, Cultural Anthropology, and Documentary Studies. And I'm guessing this is where she met our next guest, Mr. Gary Hawkins, who's a veteran documentary maker, educator, and writer. He's a Sundance Fellow and a mentor to both the Accademia d'Arte Conservatory in Tuscany and the Maisha Film Lab in Uganda. In 2009, he was endorsed by Daily Variety as one of the top 10 filmmaking instructors in America. He currently teaches screenwriting, acting for the camera, and nonfiction filmmaking at Duke University. And then pianist, composer, and educator Jason Moran is the artistic director for jazz at the Kennedy Center. Some of his recordings, I mean, there's so many, I won't list them all, but you should seek them out. He joined the faculty of the New England Conservatory in 2010, where he currently teaches an annual masterclass. Mr. Moran has garnered much critical acclaim, as you can imagine, and won a number of awards for his playing and compositional skills, which combine elements of post-bop and avant-garde jazz, blues, classical music, stride piano, and hip-hop, among others. His many awards include a 2010 MacArthur Fellowship, otherwise known as a Genius Award, and a 2007 USA Prudential Fellowship awarded by United States artists. Please join me in welcoming our guests today.
Good afternoon.
Hi.
I haven't watched that in a while, so it's a throwback Saturday, as they say. But a real thrill, also because when we all met each other, I don't know how many, six years ago, it was around Thelonious Monk, and it was at Duke University. And so to kind of be back here to kind of talk about how this actually happened, it's a lot of magic that comes together, and there's a lot of support that comes together to kind of create a project like this with a lot of minds, as you can tell in that film. So that's my opening statement.
I just had a quick...
Yes. Yeah, help us out a little bit.
I don't know if I can help you out, but I just wanted to say what an incredible project and what an incredible film, and the collaborative nature of it is just... Doctor Who. It's just Doctor Who. No, it's not Doctor Who. It's kindly turn off your mobile devices. And
that was strange.
Anyway, it's amazing. It's an amazing project. It's an amazing film, and it's so interestingly made. And I wondered if you could start off maybe by talking about the genesis of the project and how you actually met and how this film came into being.
The film project started much after the original background of the Jazz Loft and
if you, I should mention, we are recording, so if you could just go
right
in. Thank you.
That's much better, isn't it?
Microphone.
Yeah, Jason, why don't you start, and then we'll jump in.
Sure. This was a commission. The original commission was to actually, as a kind of hint earlier, is someone approached me to play, to celebrate Monk's 90th anniversary, to perform Monk at Town Hall record, and just play it as a concert. And I responded that I thought it was a good idea, but yet a boring idea for me to just play somebody else's music. But that I would imagine something much larger because Monk looms so large in who I am as a person. And he means so much more to me. And so I threw out this idea. And kind of when I'm in the middle of a commissioning project or in the middle of a commission, I kind of just talk to people at random and see what they respond, how they will respond, what I ask them. And so I told a writer for the New York Times, Ben Ratliff, about what I was embarking on. And he said, oh, you know, you need to go down to Duke University because they have this Jazz Loft archive that this guy, Sam Stevenson, is kind of heading up this major project. He was working on a book about the photographer W. Eugene Smith, and then all of a sudden he found all these tapes, which were just sitting in a closet. All these tapes of Thelonious Monk rehearsing. And it's not just Monk on these tapes. There's tons of other musicians on there, too. All these private tapes. It was unbelievable find, you know? So I went down to Duke and working with the Center for Documentary Studies, and that's when we kind of all started kind of running into each other because it was a real kind of became about, a part about digging. You know, the record already exists, and that music already exists in such fine form, but here is all this narrative of how we get to the record that is now has to become part of this performance that I'm going to try to do. And so that's when we all met. And then in 2009, we performed this on the 50th anniversary at Town Hall, and that's when Duke University came up with this great idea.
So, okay, so when we came into it, this was a really humble desire to get the numbers up in my intermediate class. My numbers were slipping badly, and Duke is just a plantation. I was a sharecropper, and I had to come up with some stuff. And so I ran into Sam and said, what you working on? And he told me about all this. And so I got up with Ledoux, and she was my teaching assistant. And I said, would you go to New York and shoot this concert that's going to happen? And she said, sure. So Ledoux became the producer of the actual shoot. On Duke's dime, we took up some Duke students to shoot the show. And we hired one professional DP, Steve Milligan, to make sure we got something. And now, wait a minute. Well, I mean, if you think about it, I mean, it's an insult to a professional DP. We train the students how to shoot, and then we just take them up to New York and go, all right, get Moran's concert. It's... There was
a couple of practice shoots on Duke's campus before.
We did some practice shoots. Oh, boy, those were scary. That's like... Anyway, we tried to... We had a lot of cameras, and we played the numbers and more or less got the show. And some of the cutting and some of the angles, which seem innovative, that was just serendipitous, you know? That was just what we had. The sound came out of a mix board and went to Ian Schreier, who worked Miracles. He had discrete tracks, and so the sound... was good, was true to Jason's concert. But we shot the concert and came back to Duke and said, we have a whole show here. We actually did have a whole show. And we said, why don't we go back to New York and attempt to deconstruct what Jason did, because I had never seen that show. I mean, we went up and saw Jason's show for the first time when we were shooting it. And the students were, too. And that's why we're late coming into solos, because we don't know who's going to stand up and start playing. It was like, oh, that guy. And I believe Aaron Stewart was the worst, because it took us 20 seconds for one camera to find him, which was pretty bad. And so we're on Jason. I'm going, oh, God. But we got it done, and we deconstructed Jason's approach. It took us a year to do that, and then we delivered the film a year later, and that's what happened.
I think it's important this part he says about deconstructing my approach, because this was part of how I tried to deconstruct Thelonious Monk's approach, and that there's almost like this kind of like this germ that gets passed once we start working together about how to change, you know, how to help a story out, but also how to, you know, it can be linear, but it can also cut away. And that, you know, that was, I remember us having that kind of conversation, you know, about how to create something that that feels like it has an arc, though the arc, you know, sometimes is refracted in another way and flips its side. And because I always feel like Thelonious Monk plays piano like this. So he somehow knows how to, as one of the musicians said, he knows how to use repetition almost like to like lure you. And then all of a sudden, he does something else that turns the corner on it. And he does this like so quick, and his band is also quick to respond to it. But this is one of the things that when I heard Monk's music as a 13-year-old, it was like so charged. It didn't sound like the Run DMC I was listening to. This is, you know, like Monk kind of was, I mean, I was listening to a lot of hip-hop in the mid-80s. And then Monk comes into the scene, and though I played piano, I had heard nothing like it. And I look at the record cover, and I've seen nothing like him, you know? And so that's, you know, that's kind of how I wanted to create a show, you know, a piece, was kind of using those ideas of cut, those ideas about style, and then also to really kind of think about Thelonious Monk as a, you know, as a historic figure, not just ending and beginning with him, but also where he comes from, you know, and really trying to see that. And being in North Carolina with them kind of also helped unearth all of that, you know, that charged American history.
And that was the trippiest part for me personally when Ledoux and I went to Rocky Mount. And we're walking around Rocky Mount, and it's the same as my hometown, Thomasville, which is 150 miles east of Rocky Mount. And I'm like, well, the buildings look the same, the people talk the same, they eat the same food, and here I am here. And then we found that we had to ask around a lot, and we found what was pretty much verified, wouldn't you say,
where he grew up, right where the split tracks are.
That's the most abandoned place ever, because you can see the pine scrub is about 6 feet tall. It's just, they didn't just raise the house, they forgot about it. And it's where the railroad track happens not to be, you know. That came full circle in a way that we found him there.
Yeah, and I mean, it really just took us digging. I mean, I remember right before we filmed the show, I remember being on my computer and looking up, okay, who is Jason Moran, you know? And like, and okay, like all these, you know, I'm listening to all your records. And then after that, you know, we knew who Monk was. The next year, Robin Kelly wrote the biography of Thelonious Monk, which is a great book. At the same time, so that was all happening too. We read that. And then digging into the story of when he lost his cabaret card, I think for me was one of the most important moments as well. And then figuring out how we're going to tell this story. And those drawings that are in the style of David Stone Martin that Gary did, you know, that was really towards the end, like 2 months before we were done editing the film, we had to figure out how to tell this story. That was really why this concert was so momentous. It was his first time back on the stage after, you know, after these racist laws, people getting pulled over for no reason. This happened to a lot of jazz musicians at the time. For him to lose his card and then have this huge concert at Town Hall, it really was a big deal. And so the rehearsal, all those rehearsal tapes, was a long time coming, and why that's such an important part of the show as well.
Can I say one thing about that just before we forget about it? There's a real narrative to the whole story, and it's not good that he was busted, and they found traces of marijuana in Nika's suitcase in the trunk, but it did lead to the Town Hall concert, which led to Jason's interpretation of it. It's so, as a narrative, it's there, you know, the normalcy, the disturbance, and everything that comes from it. And I remember where I was when we left that to the last, because we knew it was important, but we didn't know how we were going to do it, probably with newspaper articles or that documentary approach. But then it hit me. We had David Stone Martin in the show, and I was like, oh, God. And it's one of those times when you go, that's a really good idea, but there's a lot of work that's going to come of that. So I hadn't drawn anything in about 20 years, and I had to draw for 3 days to reteach myself how to draw. And then I drew the images, and I told Ledoux about it. And Ledoux's a card-carrying genius. She goes, I'll learn After Effects. And she learned After Effects in about 2 days, and I remembered how to draw in about 2 days. And then we set about doing it and putting together that, what would you call it, an animation, I guess, of it. Yeah, animatic, maybe.
And also, the last thing about that is that in trying to distribute that history, it was really important for me to be thinking about Thelonious Monk not just on the bandstand and not confine him to his narrative just as a musician, because that'd be a fault that I would never want anyone to actually take with my history as a musician either. It's my history as a citizen, especially a citizen through music. And so, I really thought long and hard, and luckily had long conversations with people who also were able to help me think about Thelonious Monk as a citizen, not just as a pianist. I mean, and Brother I, is DC's own on WPFW. He and I had a long discussion just 2 weeks ago at the Kennedy Center, listening to Thelonious Monk's music together for an audience to talk about kind of how he felt about, he has this great story I'll tell about when he was a kid in the Bronx, he'd be playing basketball, and he had heard about Thelonious Monk. And Thelonious used to just hang around the basketball court, just kind of like watching, right? And then one day, Thelonious went into the community center and dragged the piano out to the basketball court and started playing piano as the kids were playing. And he has this song, Monk has this song called Evidence, kind of, Evidence. And it's traced to that story of him getting busted, he has this song called Evidence that is these really kind of like, bump, bump, bump. And then so Bob Northern gets up. He's 80. He gets up and he starts demonstrating. Bump, 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 bump. But he did this entire like choreograph. It was like Merce Cunningham meets Thelonious Monk. It was like awesome moment. And I was like, oh, that's my second piece. The next piece I'm going to make about Thelonious Monk happens at a basketball court with some kids just playing.
I
anyway.
Want to shoot that.
But yeah, but it's really important to think about him like that, as a person who's not just on the stage, who's not just living on those great recordings that we have. This is a person who comes from lineage, and then he leaves lineage behind him, too.
Maybe we should open up for questions. There's one right here.
Yeah. I have two questions. One is personal and one is filmically. It's just very well documented, very well filmed. And in particular, I wanted to say kudos to the editor because they had in one frame like two or three musicians, and it was such a well done, it was seamlessly done, and I just wanted to say how well whoever decided made those decisions, it really was excellent.
Do you want a response to that first?
Sure.
Okay. I met this girl when I was teaching summer school, and I mean girl. She was 15. Her name was Kelly Katzenmeyer, and she had already made 6 films. She was a phenom, and she made a student film that was like a Cassavetes film.
Oh, yeah.
And so Kelly lives near Duke, but she was 15, I think, at the time. We made it a little bit older than that, maybe 16. And so she would drop in on my classes at Duke, and I told her what I was doing. Now, when Ledoux and I went to Rocky Mount for the first time on a Saturday morning, Kelly had the day off. She's 16 or 15. And so I said, Kelly, why don't you cut the opening? I want to see what you do with this. Cut the opening to In My Mind and cut it to Jason Zirphone's song. And I said, I just want to introduce everybody and cut it to this song, and that's all I told her. And she didn't even know where the footage was. So by the time Ledoux and I pull into Rocky, it was before we got to Rocky Mount, I get a call, and she says, I think I have something you're going to like. I thought it was going to take days, and this is a 90-minute drive. And she completely knocked it out in 90 minutes, and we thought, well, that's, a teenager. But Kelly was like, I'm going to do my physical thing. When she walks up to a computer, her hands come out before she reaches it. She goes, And when it doesn't work, she stands up and puts a spell on it. And so when I came back, I saw what she had done. And it sounds weird, but it kind of felt like Monk. And it felt like Jason. It felt musical, the way she attacked it and was offbeat. So I made a study of her opening, And we cut the rest of it, mostly I cut the rest of it. But I cut it in, after being inspired by Kelly's 15-year-old attack on it. So there it is.
Well, my second question real quick is, the chair that you sit in, is that just for that day, or is that something that you travel with? Because I always think that pianists always, chairs are personal.
They are personal, and there's a thing about it in the piece, too, that I talk about how snobbish I am about the chairs. So it was perfect to walk through this collection of chairs outside. Great seam right there. But I am, and I have, so I have two versions of that chair. I keep one in New York, and I keep one at the Kennedy Center. So every performance I do at the Kennedy Center, I do sit in that chair. Pianists generally have to reintroduce themselves to the piano that they arrive at, and it's very personal. All the wood, all the touch, how I always call her, she's a woman, how she responds, what she wants to talk about. Each piano has a different conversation that they want to have, and I have to figure out how to do that. So my chair is kind of like, okay, so I can rely on this chair being here. At least I feel comfortable when I sit down and say, so hey, what do you want to talk about today? You know, and it really is. And so the chair really kind of helps that. Glenn Gould had one that was all tattered and beautiful. This is my version, yeah.
So did Thelonious Monk ever get his cabaret license back? Was that a permanent?
Yeah, he did get it back, and so that concert was kind of like the start of it. So once he gets it back, it kind of he's on his way again. But the strange thing that happened at that concert was the concert was reviewed terribly by the New York Times, like awful review that they got, and they had already had a string of concerts set up for after the concert. Following, you know, the next week and a half or something. And they canceled all those shows once they saw that review. So it was kind of, you know, like a, yay, I got my card back. I got this new music. And I thought I had all these gigs, and now I don't, you know. But, that cabaret card thing was just real crazy. I talk to musicians about it frequently just to hear them kind of try to explain or rationalize how silly a law that this was.
Mr. Monk's use of repetition, as you mentioned, both in the film and here, it's a good example of how he organized confusion in his performance, as well as you have your own methods of organizing confusion. How much has he influenced your style? From when he was your inspiration, but how much has he inspired you? How much has he changed your style into sort of what he does, and what do you bring to it?
Well, I'm still working on what I bring to it, but, you know, there were days. I mean, the reason I wouldn't perform Monk's music in public until this project was because it was too personal. You know, it's like saying I'm going to talk about my mother's death every day. I don't want to do that. So Monk is so personal that I didn't want to just play at his songs in a concert. I never did it. My band existed 10 years, and we never played any of Monk's music in public until this project came along. And then I was able to kind of actually search through the reasons I was drawn to him. You know, I think going through puberty while hearing Monk kind of helped, you know. In the mid-80s, Clint Eastwood also made this film, Straight No Chaser, about Monk. That helped. It was like, okay, so not only am I getting into this music and this musician, but also, okay, so there's this film about this guy too? Okay, this seems like a right path. But I think what it was, I mean, then there's the style thing. I bought like all the 80s versions of a bunch of crazy hats. So I had like 20 hats in high school, you know. It was really silly. I still am wearing hats today. It's because Monk. I mean, this is still a holdover from how he represented himself. There's a great story. Someone told me, who was it, last week, because we've been talking about Monk so much, that Art Blakey went over Monk's house. Monk was sleeping. Monk gets up an hour later while Art is still there. He goes and takes a shower. He gets dressed. He puts on his full suit, puts on his overcoat, puts on his hat, and he lays back down and goes back to sleep. And it's like, wow, beautiful, you know. And everybody who kind of, I think, came into contact with him had that kind of relationship to him. So as a pianist, I really try to, you know, of course, I've spent many years trying to play like him, and then many years also write on the back of my hand, like, don't play Monk, you know, like, really, I would write it, like, no Monk, because it's just all inside. And so this way, I just tried to look at him like, you know, like his music was an object, and it was made to be tampered with, you know, that it was clay, that it was malleable, and that you could just pull off a piece of the clay and put it on the table and, I don't need to look at the rest of it. Let me just look at this. And so that was my approach to it, you know.
And the story you told about them dragging the piano out on the basketball court, I think, you know, that at universities they should all be a requirement to take a music class, and not just the history of music, but they should have try playing different musical instruments to realize how difficult that is. It's just so much fun, you know. It just encourages everybody. And I also liked the bit where you interviewed all the musicians. That was very much fun.
Did you do all the interviews? Yeah.
The two of us did. Yeah, Gary was sitting in the chair. I was behind the cameras.
Especially the guy with the long hair.
Yeah. Isaac.
He encourages all the young ones to want to play, you know, and just because you look young and hip doesn't mean you can't appreciate the old-time music and incorporate that into the new. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
I was going to say one thing. It's shout out to
Brian. Brian McGinn in L.A. Isaac's like the one interview we didn't do, actually, because he lives in L.A., and we couldn't get money to go to L.A. So we did two trips to New York to interview everybody, because everybody was pretty much in New York. And Taurus, we interviewed down at Duke when you guys were playing, again, with Lines. And then Brian McGinn, who's another filmmaker who we know, who went to Duke, who was a former student of Gary's, interviewed Isaac. I mean, we probably drove him crazy with the instructions we gave him.
Yeah, we just made sure that we watched the composition and coached him, and then annoyed him to death. And but he got a great interview. It was a proxy interview.
I'm just curious if Phil Woods took any interest in this. I think he's the other surviving member.
He is. You know, I haven't talked to Phil about this. Eddie Burt, the other trombonist, he passed away maybe less than a year ago. So Brother I and Phil Woods are the only remaining members. I've yet to show it to Phil. But yeah, Phil's contribution on the recording is insane. He plays some of the best, you know, solos on the record. But yeah, that was the other thing, was thinking about, you know, because there was also this moment, I really tried to think generationally, like, about how to approach who should play the parts. You know, of course I could go back, at that time when we made it, Donald Byrd was still living too. Like, should I go back to these musicians who played it originally? Should I go to Brother I and Eddie Burt and Donald Byrd and ask them to participate? But I really wanted to make sure that my generation of players got a chance to play this music, because that's how it really continued. Like, they made it, and then we got it. Now we play it, and then hopefully somebody else will continue to know about that town hall concert. It's a so that's the thing that, you know, that I constantly try to learn how to navigate, you know, to include those masters, like, into the conversation.
Well, you did have Bob Stewart, who was kind of
Bob
great
is great
master.
And interviewing all the musicians, everybody was so humbled and honored to be able to play this show and this music, both with you and to be able to play Monk's music. And that came across, I mean, there was just the utmost respect for the concert, for the music. I think that comes across in the film.
Sure. The use of the trombone, the tuba, doesn't show up too much in jazz these days. Do you know whether that was Overton, Monk, whose idea?
Yeah, I'm not sure. I mean, I might say it's Overton's idea, you know. But, you know, Monk's relationship to great bassists, you know, and what the tuba represents kind of in the evolution of good bass playing comes from the tuba, you know. So I don't, you know, like, that's the other part, is that, you know, is that all, like, having that ensemble of musicians on stage, those instruments, brings out this part when we play Blessed Assurance. It lets that happen. I mean, you know, here in D.C., you have these great trombone choirs, you know, playing at the D.C. Metro stop. You know, just this morning I heard something just, like, blew my head off, you know. It was unbelievable. So, you know, like, so it's a part of that, you know, that the thing about brass and, you know, and funeral bands and marching bands and, like, what they're capable of doing, which the piano is not able to do. And so having, like, Bob and the tuba and Isaac and the trombone and Ambrose, the trumpet, like having that, the thing that kind of connects us back to that early, you know, James Reese Europe thing, you know, all that early jazz history is important.
I saw Monk a few times. He was awesome.
Was it here in D.C.?
I saw him in the Five Spot. I saw him here in
the Five
his
Spot.
His presence was...
yeah, right.
And he always wore hats.
Yeah,
Can I say one more thing? Didn't he teach at Juilliard?
Overton.
Bob Stewart.
Oh, Bob Stewart does teach at Juilliard now, yeah.
You could tell he was a teacher because one of the things we insisted on was that when we interviewed these guys that they had their instrument with them. That was part of it. We had two microphones, two recorders, one for the voice and one for the instrument, which is much louder. And that way we could go back and forth. And Bob Stewart was amazingly generous with that third, that ghost note thing and how much time he spent with, you know, you see these music docs and you just, I've always had the question, well, how do you do this? And they always start talking about their girlfriends or drugs or something. like, who cares, man? It's like, how do you do that thing? And so we stayed on that. We stayed on point.
It's very inside. Like, yeah, it's
very,
very
inside.
Inside. Yeah.
Thank you. Yeah, just on the trombone, the House of Prayer is right up the street, and you can go any Sunday morning and just hear them. Thank you for this. And, of course, Monk had a great connection with D.C., with Charlie Rouse, Butch Warren, Donna Berry, and all that. But I want to go back to Mr. Moran to this question of blessed assurance. In my mind, as you say, blessed assurance is sort of the center of the of Monk's feelings, so to speak. But it's one song that he didn't write, and he didn't write that or amazing, you know, Abide With Me and songs like that. But it's very much Monk.
It is.
And I'd like you to just tell me a bit about that.
Yeah, well, you know, there's the history of him playing with an evangelist and being on tour with an evangelist. And in one interview I read, he's like, my favorite song, my favorite hymn is Blessed Assurance.
If you've ever been to any black funeral, it's one song you'll always hear.
Yeah.
I don't care how religious you are or not.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, and so it's also, and so that then gets to this thing about, you know, him acknowledging that and continuing to play that song, kind of, you know, in his career, like he doesn't let it go. This feeling of what music does to the spirit, how it charges people, you know, and so us going out even at the end is like a ring shout. Like we make a ring shout out of Crepuscule with Nelly. You know, and we get together and we make this circle and we play this until almost we exhaust ourselves. And then we recognize each other and then we recognize our audience who was gathered around us at that point to leave the theater. And so, you know, and also like Monk when he, you know, like some, I think maybe it's in Robin Kelly's book where he talks about, you know, the things that Monk would have seen, how music transforms people when he would do these tours with this evangelist. He would have watched people lose themselves in their body, you know, when the spirit gets into them. And when, I mean, you'd have to go and do your own research, but there are great videos of Thelonious Monk dancing while his band is playing, the spinning he'd do, you know. And I'm positive Merce Cunningham watched the Monk. I'm just positive. They had like a little thing. Anyway.
I think it's about 1:15. We have maybe time for one more quick question, if anybody has one.
I really loved the film. Thanks a lot. And I really loved the performance last week at the Kennedy Center. Looking ahead, are there some other projects on the drawing board, Jason, similar to this, where you're doing a deep dive into a musician or reimagining someone's music?
Yeah.
And secondly, what else was in that closet full of tapes of significance that you can mention?
You know, I mean, there's tons of Lee Konitz, there's tons of Rahsaan Roland Kirk, there's tons of Paul Bley. There's interviews of, there's a chopped up part of this interview that Hall Overton does with Thelonious Monk at the New School. Then there's another interview that Hall Overton does at the New School with Sonny Rollins and his band. And then there's the full recording of that too. because W. Eugene Smith used to just put his microphone up to the radio and just record things that came on the radio. He would record television programs too. So it's, I mean, it's tons of stuff. But yes, I mean, actually, being here in D.C., I've been thinking a lot about where this stuff happens, where great music has happened in America, and especially my relationship to Harlem. So right now I have two projects showing at the Venice Biennial in a month. One is about the club, the Three Deuces at 152nd Street that all those people used to play with, and the Savoy Ballroom, and looking at the stage as sculpture. But because that doesn't exist anymore in New York. But here in D.C., we have the Lincoln Theater, you know, like in beautiful original form. And I haven't told them yet. So actually, this is the first time I'm actually talking about it in public. This is what's been going on in my mind for the past week while I've been down here is, oh, well, we should really look at that and revisit the ghosts of that theater in a way, in a very charged way. And I don't know how long it will take me to do that, to create something like that for the Lincoln, but it's something that I've been thinking about because so much music happened down here for so long. I'm kind of obsessed with jazz history. I like these places where music still exists that, you know, and D.C. has seemed to have been able to hold on to some of those places, and New York gets rid of a lot of them. The Village Vanguard, of course, is the one I hold up high, you know, at 80 years old. It's my favorite place to play, period, because of all that history. And when you step on the stage and you make noise and you shake the dust off of the lights, you become part of that history. So I want to think about what is that going to be in D.C. At the Lincoln. But yes, thank you all for coming.
Thank you.
This has been a National Gallery of Art podcast.